It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, thank you for tuning in once again to the It's Going Down podcast. We're joined here today with none other than John Zerzan, a longtime anarchist, longtime author. He's wrote several books, including Future Primitive. The latest one is, what's the title? It's Hope, or Why Hope?
Well, yeah, that's, but there's a brand new one called a People's History of Civilization that's wow. Coming out just now.
Okay, also involved in the long-running and very important journal Green Anarchy, which we'll talk about. But this is part of our series looking back at the 1990s. So we're going to be talking to John just about Eugene Oregon in the 1990s and the early 2000s, about his life, about ideas, and also we're going to be going towards the present day to pick John's brain about some of the things that he likes to talk a lot about, like such as the phenomenon of mass shootings and how that fits into domestication civilization. But just to get started, John, can you briefly describe how you first got involved in radical politics and also how you began to call yourself an anarchist?
Well, that's from the 60s. You know, I was in the Bay Area. I went from Stanford to Haight-Ashbury after I graduated, went up to the city, and that was 66. And, you know, during the movement of the 60s, and I was... most of that time, I was actually a labor organizer for an independent union. But I was looking around for anarchists, and you'd think there would have been some, but there were wobblies. But, you know, for them, the 60s was like the 50s. They played no role really at all. And my main experience was with this do-it-yourself union in San Francisco, white-collar workers, clerks, welfare caseworkers, some hospital workers. And that was my main sort of education, and plus rioting in Berkeley on the weekends kind of thing. But I was just really from the 60s, and that began a kind of a long, slow exploration of what domination's all about, starting with an interest in unionism, because let me just start with this little story. There was a guy named Donnelly. I was just in Department of Social Services, City and County of San Francisco. I was there for about a month or so. Money ran out. I sold my beat-up car and had to get a job. So I went to work there. Anyway, this guy, Donnelly, he was kind of a lifer, you know, you'd say, for somebody who's not going to be militant or anything. He was retiring on a Friday. 5:10, he was fired. And so they wouldn't have to pay his pension. It was just so shocking. Really, even now, it's kind of unbelievable. But and the union, SEIU union, by the way, Local 400, way before they became sort of liberal, I guess, did nothing. They were just do-nothing, corrupt, typical union, really. And so we had to form our own. And so we just sort of went from scratch. And we were against contracts, against paid employees. And it was pretty interesting. You know, it was part of the 60s, too. It was lots of, you know, obviously everything was going on. So what I found out was organized labor was our biggest enemy. They hated us. They made sure that, I mean, we'd have reporters coming around saying, this is really phenomenally interesting. Going to write this big piece. And we'd just look at each other and smile. Glad to talk to him. But no, it's a union town. Never one article about it, even though these reporters would get all pumped up about it, but never happened. So that's where I took off from. And then I was, after that all died down, I decided one way to avoid work is be a grad student. And I started in on, well, on my own, actually, the question of unionism, the role of unionism as a, the early unions as a disciplinary force, along the lines of Foucault, the carceral role of institutions. And that kind of led into the question of technology, that technology itself is disciplinary. So anyway, I started going in that direction, and it ended up, not necessarily ended up, but it, you know, it also leads to the question of the origins of it all, the roots of it. Where does that start? And I think it starts with domestication and civilization. It goes back all the way back there.
Mm-hmm. And just curious, you brought up Wobblies in the 60s. Were you aware at all of the Rebel Worker and Heat Wave? There's a book called Dancing in the Streets, Anarchist IWW Surrealist Situationists in the 1960s. Was that on your radar at all? Or
The latter publications, no. But I actually was a Wobbly briefly during that period. Uh-huh. And I thought that would be one part of the, you know, of the struggle, you know, whatever we call it. But they didn't really do anything in San Francisco,
right?
Except, you know, kind of collect dues. There was so much more, way more interesting stuff to me. I had a very workerist point of view. I was more like our union experiment. I think it was part of what in Europe was called the long march through the institutions. And meaning you can't bring down the system out on the streets. You've got to be inside. That's the lever. That's the way you destabilize it. And ultimately, have some real role in bringing it down. Otherwise, I mean, we just kind of laughed at people in the streets in general. I lost that point of view kind of obviously, but I was thrilled about what was going on Berkeley, you know, including the weekly rioting and stuff. But yeah, that's my point of view. So I thought that would be the Wobblies, certainly be part of that. But they just seemed like kind of bureaucratic and tame and collecting their little dues and stuff. And I didn't really have any time for it.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to hear more about John's critique of unions and just kind of institutionalization, there's a great essay called Organized Labor Versus the Revolt Against Work. You can find that on LibCom and other places, but that's kind of a really good introduction, along with some other texts about just unions in that period. But just kind of turning now, I mean, I just think your history is really interesting because you had kind of this background as a labor organizer. It's our understanding that you were influenced by the Situationists, and also you met with them at some point. Is that true in France?
I didn't meet with them in France, but I met with some of the like Tony Verlon. He was living in San Francisco after a while. You know, I discovered the Situationists toward the end of the 60s. I think maybe a little bit like the radical women's movement. It kind of came in sort of in the late in and not in time to play a very big role. You know, this was like 1970, and you know, it started first in Berkeley and that area in terms of the whole movement of the 60s, you know, way back to free speech and fall of 64. Also ended before it had even spread to some other places, say in the U.S. It was already over in San Francisco, really like 69. The drugs had moved in. It was really over. And yeah, like I said, I think there were lots of other places that were just getting started.
And then you started writing at some point for Fifth Estate. I was curious, what period was that when you started kind of getting into that, really publishing with anarchist publications?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting in the sense that you mentioned that organized labor versus the revolt against work. That was early 70s, and it was published in the theory journal Telos, mm-hmm. 72 or something, 73 maybe. And Freddie Perlman contacted me. I was not in touch with him, and he told me about Fifth Estate. And by this time, it was like the mid 70s. I was thrilled to find out about it, and then to have some collaboration with Freddie for a while. Not in Detroit; I'd never been in Detroit, but yeah, that was. I think the first thing that I had in Fifth Estate was 75, I think. So yeah, that started a long collaboration.
Mm-hmm. And for those that don't know, Fifth Estate is I think one of the is the longest running anarchist anti-authoritarian publications in the United States. It comes out of Detroit, Michigan, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it kind of started in,
I think you're right.
Started in the 60s, was always kind of anti-authoritarian, but definitely had like a countercultural vibe to it. But it definitely by the mid 70s and 80s kind of took on a very anti-tech, anti-civ perspective. I don't know if you just want to share your thoughts on it.
Well, yeah, Fifth Estate, the original, was fading out in the mid 70s, like the Berkeley Bar. Rather famous Berkeley Barb in Berkeley. And as I understand it, like the Barb, it turned to sex ads and it was all about dope. I mean, it just really lost any kind of radical thing pretty much and then failed. But in Detroit, the Eat the Rich Gang, as they came to be called, the Werbys, several other people, just took it over. Uh-huh. The Fifth Estate kind of offered it to them, and their condition was, now it's ours, you know, get the fuck out, we're running it now. And it was totally different and had a big emphasis on radical ideas from Europe, as you know. I think the Kamat and Elul and others, mm-hmm. sort of like the journal Telos, only better. They were bringing in the best radical thinking from Europe, and way different from the last throes of Fifth Estate, you know, as it was really fading out.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting, this kind of like influence of like anti-state Marxism on what would become anti-civilization, anarcho-primitivist ideas. I just think that's kind of an interesting thing that a lot of people don't talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kamat especially, right?
Yeah. So I think the next question is just you're writing for Fifth Estate. That's introducing a lot of these new ideas that a lot of people haven't heard about from Europe and different places. I think the next question is just, how did you end up in Eugene, Oregon? You said you were in the Bay Area. What kind of brought you to Eugene, and what was kind of going on when you got there?
Well, I was born in Salem, Oregon. My time in California was it was 81. I think I moved back to Oregon. Everything was dead by then. The punk thing, the edge of the punk thing was over, and you know, it was getting more expensive. I just decided to come back to Oregon and give that a try, and ended up in Eugene. And really nothing was going on. I just felt like, man, this is a long time since the 60s, and it might be a long time more, you know. And but then you know, as happens, then things get going again.
Can you just we're going to be primarily talking about the 1990s, but just while you were in Eugene in the 1980s, what was going on? Were you mostly just writing or just kind of living, or what was happening?
Yeah, I was writing to some extent, and with Dan Todd, we had this Anti-Authoritarians Anonymous. We were doing some posters and flyers, and that had quite a bit of an anti-tech cast to it, at least some of it. And it was pretty situationist oriented too, I'd say. Uh-huh. But there was nothing. There was some peaceniks and stuff, but there was really nothing. It was just like so many places, the 80s pretty much dead. Uh-huh. Well, so I got into this co-op, the East Blair Housing Co-op, later in the 80s, and that enabled me to have a little more slack, a little more time. I didn't have to sell my plasma to, you know, for money.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't have any money, so that was really helpful, and it was a great experience too.
Yeah. And that co-op was still there, right?
Yeah, yeah. In the heart of the Whitaker. Yeah, yeah. Very cool.
Can you I think this is important, actually. Can you just talk about the Whitaker neighborhood? Because I think this is going to kind of build the context for what we're going to talk about later. But just what is it? Why is it important? What's its history?
Well, as a neighborhood, it's kind of the near northwest part of Maine. And as I understand it, it was always kind of a thorn in the side of the Maine powers that be, you know, more, kind of nonconform. Maybe some artists there, just people that were not mainline people. The oldest part, I think the oldest neighborhood, the only neighborhood that was somewhat mixed, strictly white, and let's see what else. Oh, in the poorest neighborhood, I think. It was kind of a likely place for, you know, if something interesting was going to happen, it was probably going to happen there.
Right. And now we're going to be kind of talking about the growth of anarchist activity, projects, movement in the 1990s. But I'm just curious, you know, how did that kind of coalesce? When did you first start kind of noticing that there was rumblings of stuff going on in the 1990s?
Well, the first thing I noticed, there was a place, and this is a really important part of it, Icky's Tea House, which really wasn't a tea house, more like a warehouse space. And they had a lot of crust punk shows there. They had a free bike corral. They had a library. And all the, you know, kind of the urban punk element hung out there. And it was open to homeless people. It was quite a presence. I mean, really, in that sense. I began to notice at the time of the Unabomber thing, 95 and 96, he was, of course, captured in 96. I was beginning to overhear these kids. And how much they got that, how much they totally understood the industrial society and its future. And I was kind of amazed. I didn't know they had, that anybody had too much interest in that or in some kind of a radical sense. And I thought, man, they know their share. They really are getting this. And then there started to be, well, we had a benefit or two at Icky's, which is kind of a minor scandal. And that was like 96, and you could feel that something was going on, kind of centered on Icky's, and there were all these mostly younger people, and I thought, shit, maybe it's finally time. Well, and one other thing I noticed, just by the way, there was this efflorescence of coffee houses, coffee shops, coffee hangout kind of places, a whole bunch of them kind of all at once. And often that's the kind of thing that tells you there's some public conversation going on. You know, there's people want to get together. And I think that was another little sign that things were starting to heat up.
And were there active tree sits? Was there a lot of eco defense going on at the time around 95? 96?
Yes, exactly. And that was the kind of equation, if you will, because I remember talking to people everybody was saying, well, not everybody, but I was aware of this idea. If the urban anarcho-punk types ever connect with the tree sitters, the forest defense people, it's going to really take off. And that's exactly what happened.
I just think that's so interesting because Ian Bone in the 1980s said about class war in the UK that their goal was to connect the anarcho-punks with the urban rioters of 81 and 85. I just think that's... just kind of that idea of wanting to bring these two kind of circles together is just really interesting.
Yeah, sometimes it happens.
Yeah. Well, how did things kind of evolve from there? You're talking about there's the stuff going on in kind of the woods, eco defense. There's all these different tree sits, and then there's kind of this growing urban kind of anarcho-punk thing. What kind of evolved from there was... what time did Green Anarchy start and kind of these more public or, you know, kind of centered projects in Eugene kind of take off?
Well, it wasn't clear that there'd ever be a connection because it sort of looked like urban youth. They were never in the woods. That wasn't part of their thing. But it slowly did become part of their thing because it began to involve some of the same people. And slowly... in fact, not so slowly, but then there was, people would like the same music and so forth and start to get together. The people up east of here at Fall Creek and the other tree sit battles, their base of support was here. You know, there were some houses that were like the base camp, and they'd come back and supplies would leave from here and go up there. And, you know, it was a connection that was already happening. But the first thing that happened, summer of 98, one of the first things that happened, there was a sort of typical protest Nike, about the sweatshop thing. People would be picketing and stuff at a Nike store here. Mm-hmm. Well, some young characters just went in there. It was on the second floor of this little shopping center place, and just started messing up the place. They started chucking stuff out the window and really fucking things up. I mean, they weren't just going to stand there holding a sign. And by the time the cops got there, they were all gone. It was a surprise, you know. And so things like that started to happen. In the Whitaker, right about that time, there were two other that happened. They tried to cut down the old growth maples along Adams, which kind of intersects the heart of the Whitaker neighborhood. There were like 35 trees over a three block stretch. And to make a long story short, the neighborhood just said, no fucking way.
Right.
Try it and you'll have a riot on your hands. And the city initially said, this is not open for discussion. This is going to happen. Mm-hmm. They're dangerous. And well, that didn't happen. They're still there. It turns out they were so ready to fall on people. That was a long time ago. They're still fine. There was one tree that everybody agreed was, you know, not in good shape, and they removed that one. All the others were still there. And then they tried to close this park, also right in the Whitaker, and they put up these gates around it, these iron fences, and every single night they were torn down for like a good week or 2 weeks, and the cops and the city folks would come and put them back up. And finally, they just threw in the towel. There are no gates or fences there now.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
And there's
some amazing shit was going on. Some really cool neighborhood, strength.
Yeah, and there's a media group we might talk a little bit about more later, but the Cascadia Media Collective, and I remember they had films about this defense of the trees, and there were people sitting in the trees too, and there was, like you said, there was a riot over these public spaces that was pretty large, and it was in this neighborhood in Eugene. I think I've told you this before, but something that's always stuck with me, a younger person that went up to Eugene about how the tree sitters up there would, when they were in the tree sits, they had to go to the bathroom, obviously, and they, went to the bathroom in these buckets that had, composting stuff and mulch. And, over the course of months and years, people turned that into fertilizer, and they sent that back into town. And the people in the town of Eugene, had gardens, and they would take that fertilizer and use it in their gardens, which they would grow vegetables. And they would send the vegetables back up to the tree sitters, and there would be this circular kind of interaction between the people in the town that were giving food to the people sitting in the trees, and then the people in the trees going to the bathroom, and then that creating this kind of interplay of mutual aid between people on the front lines and the people in the town, which I thought was really interesting and beautiful.
Nice. Yeah.
Well, I was wondering now if we could switch to just the start of Green Anarchy, and also just kind of the wellspring of anarchist thought and publication that started to come out of Eugene in the late 90s. When did that start, and kind of how did that get off the ground?
Well, that whole sort of syndrome, I guess, started kind of naturally. Black Clad Messenger, there was disorderly conduct, and it kind of merged into Green Anarchy magazine, which ran from 2000 to 2008. And that was really, really encouraging, too, because for one thing, it cost $3,000 to print, $3,000 to mail out, free to prisoners. And we thought, we don't have any money. Where on earth, where does the money come from? But there was support. There was interest. Uh-huh. There really was. People wanted to see it. And I'm still just kind of incredulous that the money did come in, and we managed. And then after a while, though, the editors, we were places. It was just hard to pull off. And, by 2008, things were damn quiet anyway.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But, it had a good run. I think that was a really important project, frankly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for people that haven't seen it, or maybe they've just seen a compilation of it, I mean, if you can get your hands on a copy, I encourage you to do so, because it was very thick, probably like, 150 to 250 pages each issue.
I don't know if it was that big, but it grew. Yeah, it got pretty substantial.
But, I mean, each page was just, like, super well-designed, just images and just different fonts, and it was just all over the place and just super packed full of information. I remember, you know, a lot of us would say, like, you know, even if we don't agree with the articles, there's just so much stuff in here that you can use, you know, whether it was news or kind of like action updates or stuff about political prisoners. Just, it was kind of like one of the few publications that just had a lot of stuff in there that you could kind of get your hands on. And, you know, you all put out, because it started off as a newspaper, and then it kind of grew into a journal, right?
Yeah, we were even able to swing having glossy covers. You know, it went from the tabloid format, as you say, to kind of more of a regular magazine. Same stuff, you know, same thrust, right. The same perspective, but it got a little better, I guess.
Right, and lots of, like, interesting interviews with people like Ward Churchill, just some really... really awesome stuff that first came out in there. I'm just curious, you know, you brought up how much it cost to print, and also, like, you know, you're sending thousands of copies into prisons. Just how did you pull that off each time? Just not only like the actual workload, but also raising the money to get it printed.
Yeah. Well, we were writing the thing that was going on, the so-called anti-globalization movement that was, you know, and then that died out, and, people are doing other things in other places. I mean, after Seattle, the heat was so enormous here. That didn't help a lot of people, you know, kind of early on. And, but yeah, now there's Black and Green Review, you know, it's, I think that's very much in the footsteps of GA.
Well, we're going to kind of backtrack now to just kind of talk about the chain of events. You mentioned Seattle 99. You said Green Anarchy started in 2000. But just kind of take us up to, we were talking about 1998, where there's a lot of stuff that begins to happen in the Whitaker neighborhood. And then there's a series of events, both in the United States, but globally around, you know, quote, the anti-globalization movement. And then in Seattle, in November of 99, of course, there's the massive WTO shutdown that kind of puts the, quote, Eugene anarchists on the map. But I'm just kind of curious, within that time of 98 and then 99, kind of what transpired? Because there was a lot that was happening in the streets of Eugene.
Well, there were a lot of stuff in the streets. I mean, there was enough militancy to be a real presence. And those years, that's when Mayor Jim Torrey called Eugene the anarchy capital of the world. It reminds me of Bush 1 when he called Portland the root, when he was met with a riot in the late 80s, I guess it was. Yeah, there really was. It was amazing, very vibrant. And it was not exactly pre-online, but much online. There were more, you'd see more things posted on telephone poles, flyers, you know, the debate was going on all over the place. Not very much online yet. It wasn't swallowed up by cyberspace like it is now so much, but just on the streets. I mean, and then right there in the neighborhood, in the Whitaker, was just and well, another thing that was happening right then is just the anti-gentrification aspect. It was always kind of a hip neighborhood, like I say, a poor neighborhood, but there was, for just one example, there was a very expensive restaurant that was established, and this could be the entering wedge. And you could see from the cars that were parked there, people with some money who might be thinking, well, we could buy a house here cheap. You know, this is a hip place to be, or it's getting hip or whatever. And the place got bricked and, spray painted and lost its windows until the people left. They just gave it up. And people weren't going to just sit by and let that happen. Yeah. And, you know, there's an interesting, if I could stick this in, I was doing a lot of childcare at that time, and involving one example, some folks I had their kids while they visited Denver, and they came back with an op-ed piece from the Denver Post, kind of a typical liberal column about this kind of stuff going on in Eugene, or they'd heard about it in Denver, obviously. So I was saying, he's putting his hands, well, you can't do that, you can't break windows and break the law. You know, that's just too far. But at the very end of the column, he said, yeah, but what else are you going to do? You're going to vote about it? Are you going to?
Right.
And he practically said, that's what you got to do, you know, if, or else just lump it.
Right, right.
And that is a fact. If you got to resist, or you eat shit, mm-hmm. you know, time, no matter what it is, right?
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering real quick if we can take an aside and just talk about the eco-defense campaigns that were going on. Obviously, there was the Cascadia Free State that took place at Fall Creek. But can you just talk about that? Like, what role did those very, you know, epic and large and, you know, public campaigns out in the forest, how did that impact what was going on in the town?
Well, I think the forest defense was first up to bat, and that really, there were a lot of people involved in that. I don't know, kind of less, somewhat less radical, but it was very popular and very effective. And right about the same time was, like I mentioned, that I was noticing how kids were getting the Unabomber deal, the ideas there, and seemed to be, you know, angry and tuned in and everything. But these were two distant, definitely disparate things. You know, they weren't, there was no connection at first. And then slowly there was a connection. People like Jeff Lewis, who was from LA, and he was initially a tree sit person. And then he was also very active in the streets in Eugene. So gradually these bridges were being built, and then it was all, it was more of a joint thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as the 90s, you know, rolled on and in a way culminated here, June 99 was a 4 or 5 hour riot.
Mm-hmm.
That was out of the blue. I mean, even though things had been heating up some, but it was quite amazing and left the cops absolutely off guard. And then 6 months later, as you referred to, end of November, early December, up in Seattle when Dub was trying to meet. And they already...
I was just going to say, the thing in the summer was the Carnival Against Capital. I think that was what it was across the world.
Yeah, yeah. And this, there was just was just going to be another typical demo. And I was having coffee with my daughter. I didn't even go to it. I just thought, you know, demos can be kind of boring. And as I understand it, the main person at the downtown protest there told about how people broke into the stock exchange in London.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah, you know, and then this guy who's really kind of a fraud, to tell you the truth, said, well, this has been great. Okay, let's go home and thanks for coming and shit. Well, people went to the nearest bank and started breaking windows. That's what happened. It went on and on. No, we're not going home. And I smelled tear gas from a few blocks away. I heard this racket and everything, and then I was aware of it. Biked on over, but I just thought, you know, one more demo. You know, they're not much.
Right.
Well, sometimes things jump out.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, let's just kind of touch on Seattle in 99. There's a great film made by people in the Eugene area called Breaking the Spell, which I encourage people to watch. But it kind of opens with you saying, well, here we are the day before the revolution in Seattle. I'm just kind of curious, you know, looking back on that now, it's, you know, now been almost 20 years. But just kind of what was the thought not only of the importance of the day, but also just the immediate aftermath of what had transpired in the streets?
Well, it was a surprise, and it wasn't a surprise, but yeah. And when I said that, when I made that comment, Tim Lewis, the videographer, you know, we were just sort of hanging out, and he said, stand over there and say something. And I felt kind of stupid. And so I just said that. I didn't know what else to say. And it turns out it kind of was the day before some real shit happened, you know. There'd been meetings like for 6 months before that. I can't remember. There was an umbrella group.
Direct Action.
And they were having endless meetings. What's that?
Direct Action Network, I believe.
I think that's what it was. Yeah, yeah, Dan. Mm. And when some of us, I mean, the Eugene types were there. They wouldn't even let us take part in these discussions, and they wouldn't let us pass out a flyer. We had a flyer that we were hand out there at the main big, there's a great big warehouse space where lots of people were meeting. That was disallowed. But you know, when I think about it, and they had this council, right? So if we'd been allowed to go in and argue to in favor of fucking shit up, we would have been voted down. So, I mean, that's kind of the point. It's a question of autonomy, as I think most of us saw it. Mm-hmm. You can have your vote. You can do whatever you want. We'll do whatever we want. And that's that. It's not some, you know, you're not going to decide this by voting. Get a bunch of liberals to say, oh, we're just going to hold signs. Well, fuck that.
Right.
And so we just kind of laughed about it. We weren't surprised that we were persona non grata. In fact, people had been saying after the riot in Eugene 6 months before, they were saying, oh, look out. The Eugene anarchists are going to come and mess everything up. They're going to go nuts, and then we'll have to. And that's kind of what happened. Right. Obviously, it wasn't just people from Eugene. No way. But, you know, they were nervous for good reason. There were people who were ready to, you know, get away from these restrictive patterns of nothing.
Right. And what ended up happening is there was more of a generalized rebellion in the streets. People came out of their neighborhoods and fought the cops. There was looting. Tried to institute a curfew. People resisted that. So it got out of the bounds of not only just a mobilization or whatever. It became, you know, more along the lines of an insurrection.
And it could have been bigger, but of course the unions policed their people pretty effectively. That was a drag, but it's just exactly the pattern. I wasn't surprised in the slightest, but there were all kinds of union people ready to rumble, but man, they pulled out the stops to put the check on that.
Right.
They did everything to keep them away from the action.
But some of them did actually break through and said, no, we're going to go join the blockades and we're going to take part in what's going on.
Yeah, there were some, but the body of them were kept away from it, and that's what I saw anyway.
Yeah.
They're the cops. They enforce the rules on workers, and there it is again.
One of the biggest things that happened is that after Seattle 99, you know, the catchphrase Eugene Anarchist became such a huge thing. And for one, you were kind of thrust into the spotlight as one of the main people that were willing to talk to the media. People, anarchists from Eugene were famously on 60 Minutes on a segment about kind of Eugene and also anarchism in general. And I'm just kind of curious, just what was that like, you know, post Seattle, just kind of dealing with that whirlwind of media just hounding you? I'm just curious your thoughts, just kind of living through that.
Well, I think sometimes you can call the tune if sometimes you pretty much force media to tell your story. I mean, that's a fact. I have no illusions about corporate media, mainstream media at all. But, you know, I don't think you necessarily have to be so terrified of it either. And of course, this is an ongoing debate, right? People I respect disagree with talking to the media. And, you know, that's just, but I think sometimes we got to break out of the bubble. We got to reach out to people. And I think that's part of it. And, you know, I'll tell you, a surprise to me was actually how often the media coverage wasn't that bad. Because, again, I think because we had the wind at our back and they, you know, they really, I don't know how this works actually, but they didn't, it didn't seem like they thought they could get away with just making a, you know, awful caricature of anarchists because actual stuff was happening.
Right, right.
Now, you know, again, I know there's people that disagree with that. You never talk to media and stuff. And of course, with media, for example, with me, I'm well aware. Sometimes it's just kind of crazy. If they talk to somebody, they have to show that this person has somehow important. So often they create it, you know. Right. Otherwise, people would say, "Well, who is this guy?" You know, or this woman. They sort of manufacture it. You know, that doesn't mean that I had some great big role or somebody else did, but. You know, that's the way that's part of the way it works, I think.
Right, right. And you were kind of thrust into this, like, oh, the theorist that tells all the children what to do and what to break, you know.
Yeah. You know, there was a Wall Street Journal piece, and this guy was out here for like a week. He talked to everybody. He talked to people's parents. Uh-huh. He was nonstop. And that was the one really awful piece. I remember it along the lines of what you're saying.
What was awful?
Yeah, like I was conducting bombing. Well, it was just lies. It was just, I mean, I'm on good terms with the parents of younger anarchists that I know and knew. And yeah, I wasn't brainwashing anyone or conducting bomb making sessions. I mean, you know, that's just hilarious. I mean, just crazy stuff. And yet he's the one that spent the most time, really much more time than anybody I recall. And the piece was garbage. It was just plain shit.
Right. Well, that's the thing about the media is that there's only so many people that can actually do like, well, what do these people actually believe or what are they actually doing? And then beyond that, you know, there's somebody that can come in and then be like, well, what they're really doing is this. And, you know, this person's telling them what to do. And actually, they're just a bunch of dumb kids because, you know, that's the other side of the coin that they can always, you know, pull out. And, you know, that's a story,
right,
that's a story that people are already prepped to hear, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, just kind of moving on, you know, I wanted to talk about, you know, in this kind of post-Seattle period, you know, there was beyond Green Anarchy, speaking of, you know, our own media, there was a lot of media stuff that was happening. There was a cable access show. There was a Cascadia Media Collective that was doing films and stuff like that. Can you just talk about beyond Green Anarchy, some of these different media projects that were happening?
Cascadia Live, that was our weekly live cable access TV show. And boy, that was really a lot of fun. That was, and the cops all watched it. It was hilarious. I remember even some of them, they'd cruise by and they'd stick their head out. I didn't say that. And then we'd just yell at them, get your own TV show.
Oh my God. You don't like it.
That was amazing, you know, because it was so right there in the neighborhood. I mean,
The show, I mean, I don't know if it's on YouTube or anything, but it literally looked like, you know, kind of like, it looked like a mash between like Wayne's World and The Daily Show. You know, it was anarchists on a talk show. And then you would play clips of like stuff that was happening, right?
Oh, yeah. It was pretty funny. Yeah. And there was this one that shocked even most of us. Opening the show, there's this guy sitting on the set, and then there's all this junk piled up behind him. We've tried to make these goofy sort of sets. And he's talking this very folksy vein about how, well, you know, you can walk around at night. You know, you almost never see any cops. And you know, you can just get out there. And he reaches behind himself and he produces this big red gasoline can. And he says, "This is all you really need." And then the music comes up and the show started. We're looking at each other like, did he really say that? And it's just, oh, it's amazing.
Wow.
But got away with it.
Couldn't do that now.
Right. Jesus.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and I remember reading Green Anarchy at the time, and there was just ads for kind of like stuff going on in Eugene, and there was like subversive theater where people would project films, and there was food not bombs going on, and there was just different events happening. It seemed like there was, you know, kind of this vibrant community of events happening that wasn't just, you know, street riots and stuff like that.
Right. There was Cop Watch, also very strong. It seemed like at one point the running joke was everybody has a video camera, you know, everybody's out to film the cops, which of course they hated. And like I said, the neighborhood defense of those trees along Adams and 4th run in there, and then the Scobert Park keeping that open. Uh-huh. You know, they tried to close it and they didn't get away with it. I mean, so yeah, there was really a lot of the neighborhood was there. It wasn't just, and of course, the people that wouldn't have identified as anarchists, but there were, you know, there was a kind of solidarity there in the hood that was unmistakable.
Do you want to just talk about that? I mean, like post Seattle, what was the feeling of people that were in the Whitaker neighborhood that had like a connection to it and kind of had like a sense of identity? How did they feel with all of a sudden being associated with, you know, black clad and anarchists?
Well, you know, it varies. And we even had a few already had some legal problems and didn't even go to Seattle. But you know, they were, ran the spectrum. I mean, there were people up there that were hating on, you know, some of the damage downtown. I mean, they just thought that was just horrible. And where some part of the picture, you know, some of the more, well, even like Earth First people, some of those people were pretty conservative, relatively speaking, and they weren't happy with it. And, you know, I mean, it just depends on who you talk to. And, just like the same way with the riot 6 months earlier, there were people that were just completely pissed about it.
Right.
But that it gave anarchy a bad name. Not even necessarily anarchy, but just the whole resistance. You know, it's just that's just stuff you don't do. And, you know, that reminds me, by the way, just one little media thing here, because I hope it doesn't sound like I'm all pro-media. But the local news here showed this one during the riot. They showed this over and over again, as I recall, guy jumping up on the hood of this pickup, and he had this chain, and he seemed to be just for no reason terrorizing this guy in the pickup. Like, this is the picture of these anarchists who are out of control. Well, what they didn't was this guy trying to run people over with his truck.
Right.
And that guy who jumped up on the hood, he could have yanked that Yahoo out of the truck and beat him, but he didn't. So, but if you just have that little part of it, it just makes it seem like, well, they're just terrorizing people for no reason.
Right.
And that's not the way it went down.
Of course. Yeah.
The targets were, you know, they were legitimate targets in my view.
Well, just kind of moving on, you know, we're going to be talking about just the role of police repression and just kind of like the end of this era. But I think another part of this puzzle is also just the underground actions that happened at the time, specifically groups like the Earth Liberation Front, which was a clandestine a network of cells that were carrying out in this period eco-sabotage actions, attacking various forestry, logging, genetic research, things like that. But how did that kind of affect what was going on, just in terms of either people's like psyches of like, wow, things are escalating, or in terms of a repression of like the FBI wanting to figure out who's doing these pretty hardcore actions?
Well, I just speak for myself, but I was thrilled by the news of like burning the Vail Resort, you know, $1 million worth of damage. Or, I mean, you know, there was a lot of that going on. And when you get to the Green Scare busts of 10 years ago, a lot of those people were from Eugene. And it was news to most of us. You know, that some people were doing stuff at night. You know, that was just not. It was. And if they hadn't trusted this junkie who went around with a wire, you know the story, they wouldn't have had to go to prison,
right?
As they did. You know, I saw Daniel McGowan this past weekend at ELAW. It was wonderful to see him. And among all the people who were busted, there were only four that didn't cooperate, that didn't rat on each other, and they ended up doing the least amount of time, which is kind of incredible. It doesn't send the right message, it seems to me. You know, Sorrell, as we call them, Daniel McGowan and three others held out. They weren't going to give any information, and they actually did less time than the ones that snitched.
Right. And for people that are looking for a little bit of context here, there was somebody in Eugene that was a heroin addict that the FBI approached and said, like, hey, we believe that you were involved in these actions. Like, we would like you to go around the country and basically get your former comrades to snitch on themselves and recorded conversations about what they did. And that's exactly what he did. And in return, he got money and, you know, he got off on the charges, I believe. But like you brought up, the people that basically turned on their friends ended up doing more time in many cases than the people that actually held on to their convictions and did not snitch on anybody.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, a number of them got 13-year sentences. And it's not nothing that the four I referred to got like 7 years. That's pretty damn heavy, but right. It was less than the others did.
Right, and they also got supported along the whole time, and now Daniel McGowan is out, and he's living his life, and you know, he's continued to do great things and continues to be involved in the movement in various ways.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, wonderful guy, man. And by the way, the junkie is back in prison.
Oh, really?
For a heroin bust.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Well, a real loser.
What are you gonna do? So that was going on. I'm just like, you know, beyond that, just the day to day. Because I mean, Eugene is not a big place. You're in a smaller town surrounded by trees. You know, the police are driving by angry that you know, they were misrepresented on the cable access show. So, I mean, that must have been a hard time, you know, just being around all these cops that must have known everybody in kind of this scene. What was that like?
Oh, that wasn't much. I mean, that was the local cops mostly. So, mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't that much harassment. But you know, people were busted on other stuff before the Green Scare stuff later.
Right.
You know, like Critter and Free, you know, Jeff Lewis got 21-year sentence on his near his 21st birthday.
Right.
He actually did. He did 10 years, and finally on appeal, they cut it down, because by then everything was over, so they didn't have to make a big lesson out of him.
Right. And again, just a little backstory: Free and Critter were two anarchists that were involved in stuff in Eugene, Oregon, tree sits, community organizing. They set fire to several SUVs on a lot that were actually later resold. And soon after, they were arrested by local police, and they were sentenced. And Jeff Lewis got, like you said, 21 years in prison, which at the time was just, I mean, it was phenomenal. Now it's like with the J20 case where people are facing 50, 60, 70 years. But at the time, you know, that was like, you know, insane that he would get that much time for basically, you know, putting some gas under some SUVs on a car lot and then, you know, facing 20 years in prison.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that happened there, by the way, while he was awaiting trial, there was another arson at the same Romania Chevrolet that torched 33 cars.
Right.
So I think Jeff felt that wasn't too helpful. You know, it's right, because then they really landed on him, and maybe he wouldn't have gotten so much of a sentence except for that, because that was way more than the first arson by a huge amount. So,
right. Well, just kind of looking back at that period, I mean, we've kind of talked about the rise and then also the repression. Was there a period that you felt like things were kind of, people were drifting away, or people just like the heat got too much for that period? What do you feel kind of like led to people kind of leaving things in Eugene behind a little bit?
Well, specifically, after Seattle, there was a gigantic pig presence here. I think there was something like 18 different jurisdictions under the main task force thing. Uh-huh. I didn't even know there were that many. It was just incredible heat, both really obvious people, you know, cops staring at you in the coffee shop and all the undercover stuff that, you know,
yeah.
It was gigantic. It was just gigantic. And I used the term Big Bang. It was like the Big Bang. Everybody went in all directions. And that's when I kind of realized how many people there were that were part of that whole deal, you know, when everybody was leaving.
Right.
But yeah, people just thought, no, it's just too intense. And, you know, by that time, well, the whole anti-globalization thing, by the way, it really wasn't anti-globalization. It just wasn't, even though it was very cool in the sense of the energy and the actual resistance there. You know, after Seattle, there was Quebec City, then there was Prague, and it ended up in, I think, July 2001 in Genoa, where there were 300,000 people in the streets and pitched battles between the anarchists and the cops. Mm-hmm. I was there. I was there later with an Italian friend of mine who gave me this tour of all that went down and how the liberals tried to help the cops bust up the anarchists and all of that story. But, you know, it was starting to wane even before 9/11. And, of course, you know, late July, well, of course, September 11 wasn't that far away. And there was some awareness, some pressure that – and actually, Henry Kissinger, he wrote a book called Does America Need a Foreign Policy? And it's really nothing about – or not very much about that, the context of what was going on. But he said in there, in passing, he said – you know, if these protest people get together with the, I forget how we termed them, but, you know, repressed third world type people, we're going to have hell to pay. And it would you begin to see a little bit of that linkage. You know, they were worried about that.
Right.
And so, of course, that's why, you know, various people feel that 9/11, they let it happen because that's the perfect way to, you know, have a culture of repression and fear.
Right. Yeah, especially when you had like stuff like 1994 in Chiapas, Mexico with the Zapatista uprising. I mean, there were mass movements going on in the so-called third world as well.
Right.
Well, just kind of looking back, I mean, you know, do you have any thoughts as far as, you know, like what you all did really well, or kind of like what could have gone better just to kind of preserve this moment, or you know, stop any of the bad stuff from happening? I'm just kind of curious your thoughts when you think back on this period.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I guess it could have been worse. I mean, it could have been more, and I say that I didn't go to jail, so it's easy for me to say, but I think there were some real high points and some real successes. And, you know, it seems like it's always a surprise. Like, as I've said before, the movement of the 60s was quite a surprise, you know, out of nowhere, out of the 50s up until the middle 60s. It was the, you know, the stereotypical 50s, just, you know, more or less consumerism, conformism, nothing much except, well, of course, the civil rights thing, especially in the South. That's a notable exception. But, you know, in the general run of things, it was pretty quiet, you know, and then bang, it exploded all over the world. So, you know, you never know. Maybe we're due for something like that. And it does seem like, you know, the Marxists were waiting for the economic collapse or something. It was a time of expansion, relatively speaking, economic expansion. I got fired. You know, you leave a job, you could get a job in the next hour.
Right.
Because they needed people. The economy was expanding. It wasn't contracting. It was no depression. Just the opposite.
Well, in some ways, that's kind of how it is now. I mean, we've talked on this program. We've had some people that have talked about, like, the Bay Area, like, there's help wanted signs all over. There's signs that are saying, like, we'll pay you $15 an hour on, you know, for fast food jobs, just because they need people so bad. But at the same time, like, things are pretty fucked up. I mean, even just looking economically, like, you know, people are working more for less wages. You know, the gig economy is having people work, you know, 15, 16 hour days for $3 an hour. I mean, so, like you said, there could be, like, a relative abundance, you know, for economics, but still doesn't mean things are good on the ground.
No, exactly. It's good you pointed that out. You know, maybe now there was quite a piece in the New York Times today about the West Virginia teacher strike. You know, maybe we're seeing, because often, or maybe always, I don't know, but, you know, you see that kind of militancy on the move. That tells you something in general, I think, so often. You know, that's a good sign. And you point out the conditions. I didn't mean that everything was so perfect or rosy in the 60s, but just relatively speaking, it was, you know, it wasn't a time of crimping down as much as it was.
Right.
The economy was, you know, doing okay in a general way.
Well, I think, you know, the thread that kind of links a lot of this stuff together, I think, that you brought up is that, you know, people like in the anti-globalization movement, I mean, things went buck wild, not because the left was, you know, instructing people to do so, but basically in spite of, you know, the left trying to manage and control things. Just like with the West Virginia teacher strike, people, it got to that point because people actually refused, you know, the orders of union leadership, and they took things onto their own, you know, into their own capacity in their own hands. But just I kind of wanted, since, you know, we have you on the show, I kind of wanted to turn now to, you know, the present day stuff that's going on. And, you know, just the first thing I want to ask is that, like, you know, when Green Anarchy was really going, you know, the idea of climate change was not new, and it wasn't like a novel idea. But still, at the time, it seemed like it was still very far away. And in today's world, where you have, you know, whether it's like NASA or just kind of like big government or even corporate institutions, you know, speaking very plainly that, like, yes, climate change is a big deal. Like, something must be done. We're going to be facing, you know, huge, huge problems, you know, 10, 20 years from now. I'm just kind of like, where is your head at when you see this stuff? Like, just how fucked up a situation we're in. And it's actually even, you know, the elite institutions are recognizing this.
Yeah, it's very confusing to me, frankly, and of course the whole Trump phenomenon is pretty surreal. Not in any way to make light of that, that's for sure. But I don't know. I'm always looking for some good sign. By the way, along these lines, there was a piece in The Guardian, a very long piece by a guy named Jamie Bartlett that I know somewhat. He's a journalist in London. And the piece was called 2018, the Year of the Neo-Luddites, ? And he was running down the different kinds of the resistance, of actual physical resistance, even illegal stuff against technology. And I think that's very much tied into the – or at least it's related to the, you know, the ecological catastrophe that's already arriving. You know, and I hope he's right. I mean, it's he sees signs that people are starting to get bored with the total immersion in the techno society, and maybe along those lines, I don't know if there's some signs that forest defense was coming back, not in a big way, but just in the past year, a little bit more of that after some period of really nothing. When they really started to come down on people in a dangerous way, like everything else, it stopped, you know, pretty much stopped. And there are some signs that's returning. They need a huge amount of that. But, you know, I'm just, you know, at my age, I've seen things come and go. They don't remain, you know, there's a challenge to come, and it comes when you're not even expecting it. You know, it just kind of pops out, and I guess that's the good thing, that it's possible that around the corner we're going to see a return of real action.
I mean, just based on your read of the situation, I mean, do you see I mean, do you just see a slow kind of progression of just things getting worse, or do you feel that, like, you know, 10 years from now, we're just going to wake up and then it's going to be, you know, some giant thing is going to happen, and, you know, that'll be kind of a wake up call, or it'll either be too late? I mean, how do you see, kind of ecologically speaking, things progressing?
Well, it's hard to imagine that people are not aware of this, despite all the false claims and promises that come from the state or technology or wherever else, like this latest book by Steven Pinker, Enlightenment Now. Sometimes I think there's, to some of these people, they're feeling the heat. They're putting up these almost desperate defenses of civilization when people are starting to see every civilization so far has fallen, and this one is falling or failing. You know, it really doesn't have any answers. So, you know, it's not, they haven't stabilized things. They haven't pacified things anywhere near as much as they'd like, even though I would not disagree with the general outlook that this is a hell of a downtime in terms of walking around, like, well, for example, on campus, I'm over at the university and working in the library fairly often, and you see all these people just zombie-like, just staring at the screens, just seemingly incapable of having real human interaction or interaction with the earth. You know, it's just kind of appalling. Like, what on earth is so – I don't get it. I'm not in the generation to get it. I'm sure that's part of it. But, you know, is that going to mesmerize people forever? It's just – it's ridiculous.
Right. And I think that kind of question brings us to our next one. It's just, you know, one of mass alienation and growing nihilism. But, I mean, you've talked about this on your radio program, Anarchy Radio, for years now, just the phenomenon of mass shootings. But this, again, is, you know, very much in the news, especially after the Parkland massacre where 17 students were killed. If you can just tell people that maybe you're not aware of just kind of your position, but how does kind of civilization and just your critique of civilization, like, intersect with mass shootings? Why do these things keep happening, and why do they happen more and more?
I guess you could go back to civilization and at least to the progress of mass society, which is, I recall various indigenous people pointing this out for some time now. That's the, like, this Ute elder I heard once in Salt Lake City saying that civilization is the grave of community, and mass society certainly is. I mean, I contend that there is no more community. So when people are cut off, drift, have no real social solidarity or bonds, then fucking anything can happen, and anything does happen. And it's getting worse. So I think, again, it's a prayer, I guess, that people are starting to see this is a very damn deep-seated thing. This is about the very nature and fabric of society. It's not, it doesn't make any sense to say, which some of these people virtually say, the existence of guns causes mass shootings. That's insane. That's not true. There have always been guns, but only since the late 90s do we see this increasing chronic phenomenon of these mass shootings. They're not going to go away. They're just not, because community is less and less existent. You know, so you get these people, it's more and more isolation and less lack of meaning, and it's just destroying everything, not only the environment, but, you know, social existence. So people just nut out, and you know, usually they're not political. That's one of the scary things about it. You know, as you know, I think, you know, the stereotype, I've mentioned this before, guy never played his radio loud. He never missed a day of work. He was always polite and shit. Then he went out and killed 20 people. Well, how do you get grasp that? How do you can't account for that by saying, well, it's too many guns or it's mental illness. Let's take mental illness. Yeah, there's been so-called mental illness, and so not so-called either, but it didn't result in mass shootings, did it? So it makes sense to just, they're desperate to try to come up with a superficial reason when the whole thing is the problem. As Adorno said, it's idle to look for this or that factor or cause when the society itself is the cause. And you got to get down to that depth, that realization. More people have to see that, and then things will then we'll have a radical challenge. Otherwise, we won't. That's right. My thought, anyway, my guess.
And I think it's important to note that a lot of these mass shootings are happening in, you know, like Parkland, you know, an affluent upper middle class, medium home value was like $600,000 or $700,000. You know, obviously the shooter was not living large. You know, he was an orphan. His mother died a year ago of the flu. He worked at, you know, Dollar Tree. But still, these things are happening kind of in these, you know, they're not happening in, you know, really economically depressed areas. It's not just because, like, the material conditions. It's because of, you know, this deep-seated alienation that people are facing.
Yeah, I totally agree. You got these white suburbs. It's more often that than not. You know, Columbine. You know, we could parse these different ones, but yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, and I mean, there doesn't seem to be any trajectory changing. Like, you know, if the elites are left up to just kind of continue to do what they want. Like, there's a there's an interesting CIA video that was produced called Megacities. That's about like the year 2050, and they talk about how intelligence agencies need to prepare for just, you know, cities getting larger and wealth stratification and just more and more people being locked into a shitty place where there's fewer and fewer resources, more people are even more economically depressed, and also there's just more of an opportunity for riots and things to break out, and they need to prepare for that by more surveillance and more oppression. So obviously these things are not going to get better anytime soon as long as this system is in place.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Well, just in closing, we've been talking for a while. Do you just want to talk about some of the projects you have going on and just how people can kind of check them out?
Well, you know, the main one I'm involved in is Black and Green Review. We've got a heck of a group of editors. It's getting bigger, and, you know, we're trying to meet the challenge of you know, reaching out and making it accessible, doing a little more promo work to, and there's some good signs there, in England, for example. But we got a long ways to go. I mean, I think we got something worthwhile to work on, but we also, you know, need to do better at getting it out there, in the hands of people and see what happens. I think that's, yeah, that's the main thing I do besides my weekly radio show. And and the latter is important to me, partly because it's the possibility of learning more about stuff from feedback. And I get a lot of great help from people. People send stories, and it's a great big boost to the project.
Yeah. Every time I see something about sex robots, I'm like, I should really send this to John.
Yeah,
which in itself is something that we could talk about for a long time, which is really strange and disgusting.
Yes.
But hey, thanks so much for joining us. Anything else you want to talk about, or anything else we didn't cover?
Oh, I probably think after we close off here, but a fan, and I really appreciate it. Enjoyed talking with you, man.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.